Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to VMB, the voice of Manhattan business, brought to you by the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. I'm your host, Bruce Hurwitz. You can find me on the web at either hsstaffing.com or fishhookbooks.com. I hope everyone will be able to join me this coming Wednesday at noon when my guest will be Ann Kamen from New York Rand Company. Our topic will be Get Connected, The Power of Referrals. To learn about all future shows, please visit our website, www.thevoiceofmanhattanbusiness.com. And please remember to visit the events page on the Chamber's website, www.manhattancc.org, to learn about upcoming events on the Chamber's calendar. I am delighted to be joined today by Thorsten Schmidt from Schmidt LLC Attorneys at Law. We will be discussing what can IP law do for your small or medium-sized business, a primer in IP law. Please remember the opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views or positions of the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. Thorsten, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I am well, thank you. I appreciate your joining me today. I know that it took a little bit of logistical ingenuity, so I thank you.
It sounds like this is going quite well. As I told you, I'm dialing in today from Germany because we have quite a few German clients. But I hope that the connection will hold throughout the call and the podcast. And before we start, let me build in a brief disclaimer from my end as well. Since we're a law firm, we have to do this, I think. Let me say that nothing that we discuss today during this podcast is meant to be or should be construed as legal advice. This is what's called attorney advertisement, what you hear today, and you should always contact your attorney if you have any matters that you need to discuss with them and get properly tailored legal advice.
Thank you for that. Now, tell us about yourself and your practice.
Well, as for myself, prior to starting the firm Schmidt LLC in 2010, I worked for over 10 years for a big international Texas-based U.S. law firm in several of its offices, including Washington, D.C., London, Munich, and then finally in New York. On IP matters, which is short for intellectual property, what we're talking about today, litigation, arbitration, and corporate cases for U.S. and foreign clients. Originally, I am from Germany, studied law there before I moved to the U.S., where I continued my studies and obtained also a U.S. law degree. To this day, I'm still admitted to the German bar, but I'm also admitted, of course, in the state of New York at the Southern District of New York, the Eastern District, and the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C.
So you mentioned
our
topic, intellectual property. I like to start with definition. So what is intellectual property?
That's a good question. I think the best differentiator here is to say intellectual property is basically everything that's not tangible. It is limited by law to three different areas, but unlike tangible assets that everybody has in their business, for example, their office building, the car fleet, the forklifts, if there are any driving around, the computers in the offices, intellectual property is the collection of ideas and concepts. Main areas are patents, trademarks, and copyrights, which our firm practices in all three of them, mainly in patents and trademarks, but we also do some copyrights. They basically exist so that there's a legal recognition for the market participants and so that market participants can gain financial benefit from the creation of inventions and trademarks and copyrights.
I don't want to get ahead of myself, and we're going to discuss trademarks, copyrights, and patents in a little while in more detail, of course. But you said intellectual property is intangible. But isn't a patent tangible because it's dealing with something that's been created that you can touch, you can hold it?
It's the method or the product that's behind it that you're talking about, but it's being protected by a legal construct, and the legal construct really protects the idea behind it. Of course, it has to be brought to paper, and then it has to go through a process that it becomes a legal right, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But the idea behind it is what's protected.
Okay. So how does something become intellectual property?
Well, it depends on the type of the intellectual property. As I mentioned earlier, there are three legally recognized types of intellectual property in the U.S., patents, trademarks, and copyrights. And depending on the type, the creation of it differs. With respect to patents, for example, there is no legal protection of an intellectual property right until the patent issues as a what's called a U.S. letters patent by the United States Patent and Trademark Office. In the future, I will refer to that as the USPTO.
Okay.
With respect to the trademarks and copyrights, both have at least some protection upon its first use or creation, respectively. With respect to a trademark, once you use it in commerce, you have a limited so-called common law protection. However, it's very limited in geographical terms and has several disadvantages compared to a federal registration with the USPTO. Once your trademark is federally registered, you can actually sue for damages, for example, including lost profits. You can get attorney's fees and your costs back, something that you cannot get if you have only a common law protection. The same applies if you register with a state. There, your registration limits your rights to the state in which you actually register your mark. But even there, you can enforce the trademark throughout the entire state with similar statutory remedies compared to a federally registered trademark. Common law trademark owners have only the right to injunctive relief, and then sometimes also under attorney's fees. Sometimes they can also get attorney's fees under Lanham Act provisions, depending on the state. Similar applies to the copyright laws. Once the copyright is created, you have a relatively limited protection unless it's federally registered. Once you have a federal registration with the Library of Congress, there is a difference. For trademarks and patents, you need to go to the USPTO. For copyrights, you need to go to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. But once you have a federal registration for copyright, you have you gain the right to sue in a U.S. court for copyright infringement.
So let's look at each a little bit in a little bit more detail. What is a copyright?
Sure. Well, a copyright under U.S. law protects so-called original works of authorship that are fixed in a tangible form of expression. What is that? Copyrightable works are, for example, included in literary works, books, musical works, songs, dramatic works, plays, pantomimes and choreographic works, pictorial, graphic, sculptural works, motion pictures, sound recordings, and architectural works. So those categories are very broad, but there's enough case law out there and interpretation as to what applies with respect to copyright.
I don't know if you know this or you're aware of this because you're in Germany right now. And I don't quite remember the details, but there is now a big to-do about copyright infringement on a song that I forget the name of the band. It's a very famous song, and one band is suing, saying that they stole the opening chords from them. And this song was first recorded, I think, decades ago. So is there any timeline? First, do you know what I'm referring to? And second, is there a timeline? Is there a statute of limitations regarding the filing of a suit for infringement of a copyright?
Well, I'm not sure whether you're really talking about timeline for how long you can sue for copyright infringement. That goes back to for how long does a copyright last. If you have a copyright, usually it is protected for a certain period of time, and they're rather complicated depending on when the work was created and or published. But in general, you can say that the term for a copyright lasts for the author's life plus an additional 70 years after the author's death. So it lasts for quite a while.
What if the author is a group? Does that matter?
There's a slightly different application for that. I think if it's a group, then it's the last surviving author's death that counts.
Okay. All right. What is a trademark?
What's a trademark? A trademark is something that we've all seen. when we go to the supermarket, for example, a trademark is basically a source indicator for a either a product or a service, it can be a word, a phrase, a symbol, a design, a combination of words, phrases, symbols, or designs, anything that identifies and distinguishes the source of the goods of one party from those of others. That's what they're called, source identifiers. If you go into the supermarket and you buy, a detergent, and you keep going back to the same detergent because you think it works very well, you're doing that because it has a certain name written on it. And it's written on it so that you can find it easier in the supermarket. If I were to go and make also the same detergent with the same name on it, but it has lesser effective ingredients in it, I'm basically infringing on somebody else's trademark.
Thank you.
Because you're being deceived. You're being deceived because you think you're buying product A from company A, but in reality you're buying product B from me.
So the trademark is really tangible.
Nah, it's not. It's tangible.
Not literal.
Once it ends up on the packaging, the creative concept of coming up with it is not.
Understood. Now, just a reminder, you're listening to the Voice of Manhattan Business. My guest today is Thorsten Schmidt from Schmidt LLC, Attorneys at Law. We are discussing what can IP law do for your small and medium-sized business, a primer in IP law. Please remember the opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views or positions of the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. Thorsten, this is one thing I have never been able to understand. What is the difference between a trademark and a service mark?
That's very easy, Bruce. If you trademark a word, phrase, symbol, or design, or a combination thereof, anything that I mentioned previously when I tried to define a trademark, if you do that for a product, it's a trademark. If you do it for a service, it is called a service mark. There's basically not a big distinction between this other than that one applies to the service and others to a product.
My confusion is that I've seen taglines, and some of them have the TM, and some of them have the SM. But it's a tagline for a service. For example, and I don't have this trademark for a service mark, but I'm an executive recruiter. My tagline, if you will, is my mission, promoting the hiring of veterans. Now, would that be a TM or an SM?
It should be an SM because what you're selling is a service and not a product.
Understood. Still confused why taglines for service companies have TM, but that's their problem. Clearly they didn't use you as an it's their attorney.
Exactly. For your next service or trademark, feel free to call us.
I shall. Now, what's the difference between the TM and SM symbols and the R in a circle?
The TM and the SM symbols should be used for a trademark or for a service mark, respectively. The R in a circle, however, is reserved for actually federally registered marks. So if you, as I said earlier, you have a trademark or a service mark once you start using it. You don't need a registration. So there's a certain common law protection right there once you use it. Once you use a trademark or a service mark, you can source, or you can basically add the TM next to it by indicating to the public that you intend to use the phrase, the word, the logo, the design as a trademark or as a service mark. Once you have a registered trademark or service mark, only then you are allowed to use the R in the circle.
And that R in the circle means if you violate it, I'm suing you in federal court, not state court.
That is correct. That is correct. Trademark law and patent law and copyright law are all federal laws, so you can sue somebody in federal district court in case somebody infringes upon your intellectual property. Unless,
so,
for example,
we've discussed
you have
this a bit.
Eight.
Is there anything you wanted additionally to tell us about what a patent is?
Well, a patent is a whole different animal, different from a trademark and different from a copyright. A patent for an invention, a patent basically protects a patentable invention. And it's basically the grant of a property right to the person who invented the invention, the inventor, which is then issued by the U.S. PTO. So you would have to file an application, and there are three different types of patents that one can actually have. One is the most common one, which is called a utility patent. The second one is a design patent, which in the past hasn't been really that that effective, but because of recent litigation, especially the public has seen how valuable those design patents can be. For example, the patent litigation versus Apple versus Samsung, and then planned patents, which I don't think we need to discuss much about today. It's about the asexually reproduction of any distinct and new variety of plants. But the most common one is the utility patent, which basically is granted to anyone who invents or discovers any new and useful process, machine, article of manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement of the above. You can get a patent for only one reason. The only right that you have as a patentee once your patent issues, after you filed an application with the patent office, you get the right to exclude others from making, using, offering for sale, or selling the invention in the U.S. or importing the invention into the U.S. What it does not, and that's something that a lot of people don't understand, what it does not give you the right to is the right to make the same product. You don't get the rights to make the product. You get only the right to exclude others. Thereby, implicitly, you, of course, have the right to make it yourself because you have the patent on it. But the true power of having a patent is excluding everybody else from your invention.
So the best example is probably pharmaceuticals. You get
for example,
the patent for X number of years, and then once, once it expires, then your competition creates, if you will,
generic versions of it. That is correct. Yes. Whereby there, it's a little bit more difficult and complex. But in general, yes. Once the patent expires, everybody else who is out there in the marketplace can duplicate or replicate your invention, and you cannot any longer exclude them from making, using, or selling it, or offering it for sale, or importing it into the U.S. That is correct, yes.
Now, you already told us that a copyright lasts for the lifetime of the owner plus 70 years. What about trademarks, service marks, and patents? How long are they good for?
Well, let's start with trademarks. Trademarks are basically valid forever if you follow the law, which says that after the fifth or between the fifth and the sixth year after the registration, you have to file a declaration of use with the Patent and Trademark Office. Basically, you have to use your trademark or your service mark. If you don't use it, it can get canceled. Another competitor could come and file a motion to cancel your trademark. But as long as you use it, and this declaration basically serves as evidence for the USPTO that you are continuously using your trademark between the fifth and the sixth year, then you can get another 5 years of protection. And then between the ninth and tenth year, you have to file the same thing. And then every 10 years thereafter, you can file such a declaration and therefore keep your trademark or your service mark alive. If you don't file those documents timely, of course, then the registration will be canceled and cannot be revived or reinstated.
And a patent?
A patent, in general, a new patent term is 20 years from the date on which the application for the patent was filed. In some special cases, from the date of an earlier related application, subject, of course, to the payment of any maintenance fees, which will have to be filed and paid throughout the life of the patent.
What can't be protected?
That's an interesting angle as well to look at this. In general, anything that falls outside of the protected scope that we already discussed. Some examples for copyright. Any work that has not been fixed in a tangible form or expression, for example, a choreographic work that has not been notated or recorded. Any improvisational speeches or performances that have not been written or recorded, titles, names, short phrases, slogans, that would be the province of a trademark, lettering, coloring, any ideas, processes, methods, that's the provenance of patents, any works consisting entirely of information that's common property and containing no original authorship, standard calendars, for example, height and weight charts, tape measures, rulers, lists of or tables taken from public documents or other common sources. Trademarks, there are five different categories, so it's a little bit more complex of things that cannot be trademarked. I mentioned earlier non-use is a big no-no for trademarks. Basically, if you don't use your mark, it's being treated as abandoned. And although there are different ways how you can abandon a mark, non-use is the prime example. The second example, what cannot be trademarked, is a generic term. For example, you cannot get a trademark on terms like computer, eyeglasses, chair, and so on and so forth, because the public associates those terms with a type of good, not a specific brand. So, for example, in the USPTO loves to see, for example, is something that is very unique and not generic, fanciful. For example, Apple. Back in the 1970s, nobody would have thought that Apple could ever be used as a term for a computer. So those are trademarks that the Patent and Trademark Office loves. It's the opposite of generic. It's something that you would initially not even think of, and it's up to your marketing team to educate the consumer that what the term you're using or the slogan you're using is actually something that refers to your services or to your very unique products that are completely different, don't have anything to do with the trademark. What a lot of people try to do, they try to bring the name of a product or a service so close to the actual service because it's much easier to market that the Patent and Trademark Office says, no, we will not allow this trademark to go through because it is so close, and it may not be a specific brand, but more a type of goods. Another example is a confusingly similar mark. Anything that resembles another mark that is currently already registered or in use that can cause confusion among consumers will not be trademarked. It's called likelihood of confusion. There are many factors involved which have been evolved through several cases going back to a case called Polaroid versus Polarap. And they're called the so-called Polaroid factors. And the case is from 1961, so it's a very old case. Another area are weak marks. A weak or descriptive mark is not protected either unless the owner can actually prove that consumers are aware of the mark. It's called a secondary meaning. A secondary meaning can also evolve over the course of several years. One of three types of weak marks, one is, for example, a descriptive mark, as I said earlier. A second one would be a geographic mark. That anything that describes the location at which you have your business. And the third one is the last names. When you try to register a weak mark, the USPTO may not permit the mark to be registered under the principal register, but it may allow it into the supplemental register. And then over time, if you actually market your trademark to a broad enough group of people, potential customers and consumers, and if they actually recognize it, then you can reapply with the USPTO within a certain period of time. I think it's 5 years, and then you can actually move this into the principal register.
The can you put the TM on it?
You can put the TM on it whenever you want to. You just have to be careful with the R and the circle. A lot of people who have a weak mark that end up in the supplemental register still put the TM on there because they can, and to the unknown lay person, it looks like as if it's a real trademark.
Okay. Now, what happens when a company really succeeds well, like Google, and someone starts using the name of the company, which is obviously trademarked, but they start using it as a verb, as in the case of Google, Google it. Now, somebody had to be the first person to say Google it. Could they have gotten a trademark on it for the verb and not the noun? And secondly, let's take Disney, Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse has to be copyrighted and trademarked. But today, people use the term Mickey Mouse disparagingly. So is that a violation?
It is. Both would be a violation. The trademark owner, however, has to be very careful to make sure that if these terms are being used in a fashion that they substitute other terms, that they actually lose trademark protection just because of that. A very often recited comparison is, for example, Pepsi and Coca-Cola. Going into one of the fast food chains that serves one but not the other, you will very easily find out which one they serve, because if you ask for a Coke, which, you know, might have become a generic term that may not be trademark protectable anymore, if Coca-Cola wouldn't write everybody to say do not use the word Coke just randomly, only if you order a Coca-Cola, that person will tell you, we don't serve Coca-Cola, but will you also buy a Pepsi from us? So there are safeguards that a trademark owner will have to put into place to make sure that a highly successful mark does not lose trademark protection. And Kleenex, for example, is another example.
Last question. And it's the title. What can IP law do for small and medium-sized businesses? Why go through all this hassle?
That's a good question. Since we represent not only bigger companies, we also represent startups. We represent smaller businesses. A lot of them are family-owned and have been for generations. Some of them have not actually bothered to look into intellectual property protection, and very often it took a very rude awakening for them to realize how important intellectual property protection is. For startups, for example, a lot of startups these days, their only or core value is actually their intellectual property, and very often it is their patents that they have. That's the only reason why they get initial funding. That's why they get a first, second, and third round of financing, and that's how they can measure up to the competition that's already out in the marketplace. Without any patent protection, these businesses would not be even in existence today. In general, I think it's increased competition that leads smaller and mid-sized businesses that haven't looked into patent or also trademark protection in the past to do that, because the competition uses everything available to them to become the dominant player in a marketplace. If a competitor does not have a patent on its main product, and it might have not had any problems in the past, but that will not allow them to think that there will not anything happen to them in the future, so that if a competitor comes in and finds out that what the process that they're using, how they're producing their product, or the method, or the product itself is covered by a competitor's patent, then it is very likely that in this landscape today that a competitor will use their own intellectual property, their own patents, and or their own trademarks, trying to cut you off or make you pay royalties under a license that they will force upon you unless you want to give up your line of business. And therefore, it's very important that small and mid-sized companies get familiarized with intellectual property law, because it can go really to the core of their own business. Patents is one example. Trademarks is another. We were talking to a client just the other day who told us that we have a company of a certain name. We never bothered trademarking any of our services where we utilize also our company name. But one day we received a phone call from a customer trying to reach his company he's doing business with, just to find out that they called the competition. So that was the way how our client found out that there is another company out there of the same name and the same industry doing exactly the same thing. And you can say maybe they were lucky because they might have gotten a new customer. But if the other customer is applying for trademark protection, our client might be in jeopardy. Anybody might be in jeopardy who is expending a lot of money on marketing for a new product or a new service before that product is actually launched or the service is actually launched, if they don't look into whether they actually have the rights to the names or can secure the rights to those trademarks and service marks. If they find out after they expended $500,000 or $1 million, it's a very, very rude awakening, and they might have just wasted a lot of money.
Thurston, I want to thank you profusely. I really appreciate you taking the time, especially since you're in Europe right now. Before I let you go, though, please tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
Sure. Well, let me thank you for having me today. It was my pleasure, and I hope that we can repeat this at some point. Once I'm back in the U.S., but until then we have attorneys in our offices as well, our firm can be reached through our main number, 212-809-1444. And anybody who would like to send me a personal email can do so. My email is tschmidt@schmidt-llc.com.
And Schmidt is spelled S-C-H-M-I-D-T.
That is correct.
Thurston, thank you again. And I do hope you'll come back on. And that it will not be a long-distance phone call.
Exactly. We'll find a time and place. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you, and a special thank you to all of our listeners, and I'm certain Thurston joins me in wishing everyone a safe and prosperous week.
That is correct. Thank you very much.